It's Friday, April 19, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. When I was about 10 years old, one day in Florida, a massive tractor-trailer rig full of gasoline exploded just about a block from our home, leading to a massive explosion that led to a fireball that went high into the sky, the heat of which we could feel for many blocks. I can still remember that to this day, and yet I also remember the fact that I had never noticed there was a refueling station for tractor-trailer rigs just that close to our home. You have to wonder if people in the little town of West Texas have a whole new realization that there, right in the midst of their community, was a fertilizer plant that certainly they knew as an employer, but perhaps did not know as a lethal bomb about to go off within the heart of their community. The fire that began in what is now believed to be an industrial accident led to an explosion that has killed up to 15 people and injured more than 170. And by reports, has destroyed about a four-block area of that little town, and with a blast that was felt as many as 45 to 70 miles away. Investigators continue to pore over the evidence there, but again, the expectation is that it is what is classified as an industrial accident. Meanwhile, on the scene of what is anything but an accident in Boston, investigators continue to pore over what are described as millions of pieces of evidence. And of course, they're looking for the public now to see if the public can give any additional information, since they have now shifted their investigative stance in order to give the public more information, even images from film and video, in order to see if that will lead to a recognition and eventually to an arrest. Meanwhile, an arrest was made in Mississippi, in the town of Oxford, Mississippi, where a Mississippi man was arrested and accused of sending letters tainted with ricin, a poison, to President Barack Obama and a senator. As USA Today reports, the incident set Washington, D.C. on edge a day after the Boston Marathon bombings. The man who was arrested is named as Paul Kevin Curtis, a 45-year-old Elvis impersonator. He was arrested Wednesday at his apartment in Corinth, Mississippi, which is near the Tennessee state line east of Memphis. Authorities are still waiting for definitive tests on the letters addressed to President Obama and Senator Roger Wicker. One of the interesting things about this, of course, in this last case, a case that we wouldn't know to talk about until this event in the headlines this week, is that there is a system here that clearly worked, a system that means that mail for our national leaders is held in reserve such that any suspicious piece of mail can then be investigated. This, we can thankfully say, is an example of a process that was put into place after 9/11 that has actually worked. And in this case, even though the headlines, of course, made national and international news, they did so because the system did work. These letters were not received. They were stopped. And we need to note how quickly an arrest came. Of course, when you're considering the annals of crime, you might consider the fact that this alleged criminal seems to have given the police a good bit of information by writing notes in these letters signed with his own initials and postmarked very close to his home. This one is not likely to go down in the history of the annals of the most intelligent crimes. But then again, that goes back to the point that crime itself is never as smart as it appears to the criminal. Even though there are cases in which criminals get away with their wrongdoing, in most of the cases, as our jails and legal record will say, criminals are caught, and crime, as the old adage reminds us, does not pay. On Wednesday of this week, Britons paused for the formal ceremonial funeral of Baroness Margaret Thatcher. Lady Thatcher was buried with full military honors in a military-scale funeral that, in terms of Britain's formality, is second only to a state funeral, which is reserved in most cases for royalty. One of the interesting things to note is that on Wednesday, the Queen and her consort, Prince Philip, were both present for the funeral. She has had 11 prime ministers during her very long reign, but she became the first reigning monarch to attend the funeral of a prime minister, which she attended the funeral of Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Now, that was a state funeral, as the late prime minister, considered one of the most important figures of the 20th century, and, as many Britons estimate him, the most important figure in the history of Britain, he was accorded a full state funeral. Margaret Thatcher was given a funeral just under the state funeral, a ceremonial funeral with military honors, and with all the formality that is known to Britain, and which, quite frankly, Britain alone amongst most nations can pull off, it was an occasion of incredible dignity. One of the things to note from a Christian worldview is how much Christianity was actually contained in this very formal state affair there in Great Britain. It is a very significant memorial to the fact that Britain is a nation with a very clear Christian heritage. It still has, of course, constitutionally, a state church, the Church of England. But as is so often the case in a formal event like this, the scriptures that were read were redolent with the gospel. The words that were said were filled with very significant Christian truth. Part of that was the fact that the main speaker at the event, the officiant, the Bishop of London in the Church of England, is himself a very conservative figure. He said, as he was speaking of Lady Thatcher, quote, "After the storm of a life lived in the heat of political controversy, there is great calm. Lying here, she is one of us, subject to the common destiny of all human beings." He also said, quote, "The storm of conflicting opinions centers on the Mrs. Thatcher, who became a symbolic figure, even an ism. It must be very difficult for those members of her family and those closely associated with her to recognize the wife, the mother, and the grandmother in the mythological figure," end quote. Remarkable in terms of the course of the event in this very formal ceremonial funeral was the fact that Margaret Thatcher the woman did appear, and the political controversies of her very long premiership, the longest in the 20th century, these were held in abeyance for the formality and also the solemnity of a funeral. As the Bishop of London noted, this was a funeral and not a memorial service, so there was no eulogizing of Margaret Thatcher, rather a very simple and fairly short Christian sermon. In the midst of that ceremony, one story was told, an anecdote from her long premiership that helps us to understand Margaret Thatcher not only as a stateswoman, but as a person, and also as a Christian, a lifelong, very devoted Methodist. Back on March the 15th of 1980, a 9-year-old boy wrote to the Prime Minister. He is the young son of a vicar from Borehamwood in Hertfordshire, and he wrote to her asking this, quote, "Last night when we were saying prayers, my daddy said everyone has done wrong things except Jesus. I said, I don't think you have done bad things because you are the Prime Minister. Am I right or is my daddy?" End quote. The little boy was probably surprised to get a 2-page handwritten letter back from number 10 Downing Street. The Prime Minister responded that little David had asked a very difficult question. Then she wrote, quote, "However good we try to be, we can never be as kind, gentle, and wise as Jesus. There will be times when we say or do something we wish we hadn't done, and we shall be sorry and try not to do it again. We do our best, but our best is not as good as his daily life. If you and I were to paint a picture, it wouldn't be as good as the picture of great artists. No, our lives can't be as good as the life of Jesus. As Prime Minister, I try very hard to do things right, and because Jesus gave us a perfect example, I try even harder. But your father is right in saying that we can never be as perfect as he was." End quote. Signed, Margaret Thatcher. The Bishop of London, Richard Schartz, preached a message that included the gospel and the hope of the gospel and the gift of everlasting life to those who are in Christ. And as Margaret Thatcher was there, as the bishop noted, in her repose and in her remains, quote, "as one of us," end quote, she was one of us as a sinner, but by her own testimony, a sinner saved by grace. A great deal of our national conversation has to do with a gun bill with several provisions that failed in the United States Senate on Wednesday. President Obama attributed it to politics. As USA Today's Gregory Corte and Catalina Camilla reported, quote, "An angry President Barack Obama criticized a Senate minority that helped defeat a proposal to expand background checks on gun purchases. Quote, it all came down to politics," the president said in the Rose Garden. In other comments, the president said, quote, "this is a pretty shameful day for Washington," end quote. Now, this is a very interesting political development and one that is more complicated than most of the press coverage would allow or reveal. What we're talking about here is a bill that even the New York Times declared on its front page was dead on arrival before its debate. There was no surprise in the failure of this bill to gain traction in the United States Senate. It failed when 45 voted against it, which meant it did not have the requisite 60 votes to move forward on the floor of the Senate. But there were very few surprises here. And the president himself, though attributing it all to politics, had done his very best in terms of his own political game and his political skill to bring about an outcome that was very different. What we're looking at here is the fact that it is very difficult to get any kind of gun legislation through either house of Congress. Even if the Senate had passed this legislation, it was almost certainly dead on arrival in the United States House of Representatives. But what was the president talking about when he said it's all politics and politics won? Well, we're talking about a political process. And in a political process, politics will always win. On the issue of gun control or any measure restricting guns or even registering gun owners, there is a lot of controversy here and a great divide amongst the American people. In just a moment, we'll look at the fact that the president again and again has come back to the claim that 90% of Americans approved of and supported the idea of expanded background checks. But there's more to the story than that. For instance, in the editorial published in yesterday's edition of the New York Times, the lead editorial read this in its first paragraph, quote, "For 45 senators, the carnage at Sandy Hook Elementary School is a forgotten tragedy. The toll of 270 Americans who are shot every day is not a problem requiring action. The easy access to guns on the internet and the inevitability of the next massacre is not worth preventing," end quote. The reason why most Americans and, at least, a sufficient number of the United States Senate members were not willing to go with this legislation is that the legislation as it stands would have done absolutely nothing to have prevented the carnage at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Those guns were legally obtained with a background check. They were indeed legally held, and nothing in this legislation as proposed and then to be debated before the United States Senate would have changed that to any degree. Furthermore, as many of the senators protested, the background checks would apply only to those who, after all, are willing to undergo the background checks and get guns legally. Criminals are not bound by such scruples, and therefore it was a false premise, they suggested, that this would actually lead to any greater safety for the American people. On the issue of guns, it's very hard to find any kind of middle ground. The polarization in this country is almost absolute, and when it comes down to the polling, it can be very misleading. The president stated, even as he was flanked by people from Sandy Hook there in Connecticut and by others associated with gun crimes, including former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords at various points in this controversy and in this political effort, the president referred to the fact that over 90% of Americans, according to polls, he said, support the idea of expanded background checks. Looking closer at that data, it is clear that if you ask the question in the right way, with the right sample, a nationwide, and let's just say fair-minded sample of Americans, they will say that under certain circumstances, they would approve such legislation and think that it makes sense. The problem is that once you actually get into the technicalities of such a law, that kind of support falls away. But there's a bigger problem that explains why the law was dead on arrival. The United States Senate is not elected nationally. Senators are elected on a statewide basis. And though it might be true, I will not contest that you can find a poll saying that 90% of Americans were at least theoretically in favor of expanded background checks, you would not find that in Alabama or Arizona, or for that matter, North or South Dakota. You would find that especially in the areas of greatest urban concentration, especially on the two coasts, where it might very well be the case that there would be overwhelming support. And, without surprise, the senators in those states were overwhelmingly supportive. In other words, what we're looking at here is a political division that is a worldview division, a political division that can't be fixed with any kind of immediately accessible legislation. That point was made very, very clear by Gerald Seib on Tuesday of this week in an article published in the Wall Street Journal entitled "Polarization is Not Just in Washington." As Gerald Seib, a very insightful political analyst, writes, much ink has been spilled, including on this space, bemoaning the polarization and divisiveness of Washington these days. Too little time has been devoted to an uncomfortable underlying reality. This polarization in Washington exists in large part because the political system is reflecting polarization in the country that spreads out beyond the Capitol. In other words, it isn't just the politicians, it's us. These divides can be seen particularly in the House of Representatives, he writes, the branch of the government closest to the grassroots, which helps explain why it has become such a deeply partisan place. Then listen to these specifics. To get a sense of the broader picture, simply look at attitudes about social issues at the top of the current political agenda: gun control, gay marriage, and immigration. Throw in the long-standing issue of abortion, and you will see why there are two major political parties and why the divide between them is so great. And I would add, apparently getting greater. Gerald Seib continues, in the latest Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, the partisan split was stark on each of these issues. Pollsters asked whether gay marriage should be made legal. Among Democrats, 73% said yes. Among Republicans, just 27%. Americans were asked whether gun laws should become more strict, less strict, or stay about the same. Among Democrats, 82% said the laws should be more strict. Among Republicans, just 27% said that. Asked whether abortion should be legal all or most of the time, 62% of Democrats said that it should, compared with 25% of Republicans. Gerald Seib then points out, if you actually get to the core of support in both of these two parties, the divide grows even larger, the polarization even more remarkable. As he concludes, Quote, in sum, it is the country that is polarized. Whether it is more polarized than it used to be is open to debate. What is clear, though, is that the divides are reflected ever more clearly in its Congress. End quote. The economist Thomas Sowell years ago wrote a book entitled The Conflict of Visions. And in it, he made the point that if you do political analysis on contested issues, you will note that you can almost always predict where someone will come down on issue B and issue E if you know where they are on A and C and D. In other words, it is a worldview divide, what he called a conflict of visions. This becomes the predictable factor in saying that if one holds to this position on gun control, there's a great likelihood that that person will hold to a similarly slanted position when it comes to the issue of abortion or the issue of same-sex marriage. And the reverse is obviously equally true. This points to the fact that there is a political divide in this country, and that seems right now, quite understandably, to be consuming a great deal of the political interest of those who do political commentary. And furthermore, it appears to be an issue that has caught the attention of the American people. But as Gerald Seid points out, the politicians aren't in the main the problem. The president said it all comes down to politics in terms of the failure of his gun bill, but after all, he was speaking about politicians who were acting as, no surprise here, politicians, including the president, but also including every other politician in the mix. But as Gerald Seid points out, these politicians were elected by someone, and they were elected for some reason, and the polarization in Congress points to a deeper polarization amongst the American people. But as we as Christians know, it's not just political polarization. It's a worldview distinction, and to an increasing degree, a chasm that separates those who operate out of one worldview from those who quite clearly operate out of a worldview that is very different. The political polarization is going to continue, we can say with confidence, so long as the worldview divide continues to be so deep. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.